sites like this Chattanooga group, they had no sense of the measure of true wilderness. But this group had solid reasons for what they had done. They insisted they had come south because they figured the Prairie Portage Station and the Summers Canoe Base were the best places to turn, and they had paddled like dogs to get here. Everyone nods in appreciation of their speed and effort. No doubt about it, that was one hell of a paddle. It has to be some kind of novice record, and they can see the group is exhausted, nerves worn thin as bare wires. Kathy and Carrie have heard enough to radio HQ. After they help the group get settled, the two fathers return to the station. Matson, Wills, and Jones huddle over the station radio while Kathy makes the call. Static comes over the line, but also a voice, and this time it is clear enough to hear. Dave Maynard, Quetico Park's operations specialist, sounds cheerful and ready to assist.
"What's up?" he asks. "How are things at the Prairie Portage?"
"Beautiful. Buggy and busy as always. Especially tonight," Kathy says. "We have a group down from Bell Lake say they lost their guide."
It takes 5 minutes for Carrie to relate the pertinent details of Stevens's bizarre disappearance. What Maynard can't figure out is what the Chattanooga group is doing at Prairie Portage. They should have returned to Cache Bay. He knows valuable time has been lost. Every passing hour expands and complicates a search area. The Matson method is the methodology used for determining the probability of area, POA, for every possible search area or route choice a lost person might take, providing he is mobile. Search coordinators compile all known facts about where the person disappeared, who he or she is, and any other corroborating information. The data is used to lay out a search area. All subsequent air and land efforts follow the quadrants laid out in the process. If Maynard recollects his details correctly, each hour a person is lost expands the POA by 5 kilometers. More often than not, lost people wander, ignoring the axiom about staying put. This one is a guide, so Maynard hopes he had enough sense to sit still. But it is very odd. No one disappears. People sometimes go missing and are never found. But they're somewhere, alive or dead. Something is seriously wrong. And he knows the sooner he can contact the Ontario Provincial Police, OPP, and get the Emergency Rescue Team, ERT, involved, the better. This guy has already been gone over a day. If Maynard's math is correct, that has expanded the search area by over 100 square kilometers. He tells everyone in the room to stay by the radio. He's going to contact the Ontario Provincial Police. He knows they will assign a constable to the case, and the constable will have questions. He will have to know the details before he moves it up the line to the shift sergeant. The shift sergeant will have to contact the duty officer. Once the duty officer is briefed on the pertinent details, he or she will decide if ERT's participation is warranted. Maynard wants to make sure it all happens in record time, because every passing minute matters. Survival, search, and rescue. Survivors don't expect or even hope to be rescued. They are coldly rational about using the world, obtaining what they need, doing what they have to do. Lawrence Gonzalez, Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why.
"Forget it," he said. "You'll do someone else a favor sometime. It's all part of the big circle."
I like the concept. Because of the nature of bush travel, you often can't repay those who help you. But you can help somebody else. Somewhere down the trail. Sooner or later, it all comes around again. That's the big circle. Sam Cook, Up North. 13. Linda Rasmussen Worries. Northeast of the Powwow Trail. Thursday, October 25, 2001. In the morning, Jason awakens to a silent world. He is tucked down inside his dark shelter. His leg still burns and his feet are numb. He blinks and discerns pinpoints of daylight through his woven branch hatch. It's quiet outside, almost eerie. He can hear a faint whisper, but he doesn't think it is wind. He did a good job covering the trunk opening. Now he pushes on the overhead weave and it dislodges, toppling forward. A light dusting of cold. White powder drops down onto the edges of his tree trunk hole. It's snowing. Jason struggles up to the mouth of his opening, and the world is blanketed in thick white. The trees and brush and the large stump from which his own sheltering trunk has fallen are smothered with several inches of dry white fluff. The thermometer has taken a wicked turn south. The snow isn't melting. At least the howling wind has subsided. He recollects the midnight storm, how he could have been crushed by the felling of one of these old giants. His leg still hurts. His feet grew numb in the deepening cold, and now he cannot feel his toes. He didn't bring his hat or gloves because he didn't plan on spending the night in a tree. In a tree! When he considers the cold white world, he is beyond shock. What else could happen to him? But now he has to get up and walk around, stamp his feet, return them to some semblance of normalcy. Normalcy? There is nothing even remotely close to normal about any of this. When he was young, the first snow was an occasion for happy wonder. Now the weight of the cold presses on his life, as though this is one more rock on the pile, another nail in his coffin, another place where the wide sanity of the world is slipping. He recognizes almost nothing about the muffled landscape in front of him, and he knows there is no returning. To try to turn back through this field of white, through woods where no trace of yesterday's journey remains, where he would be unable to tell if he was walking over a bog, a flat forest opening, or his grave, is unthinkable. The deepening of his predicament is devastating. He tries to focus on his surroundings to distract himself. When the huge pine toppled over, probably in one of those windstorms, Jason suspects, part of the tree's side splintered away from the trunk and remained connected to the 10-foot-high stump. The rest of the tree fell away, but the slab of splintered siding formed a long, wide bark overhang. It extends from the stump to the top of the fallen tree. It is like a giant, rough-hewn tent awning, and in this snow it provides some cover over the ground in front of him. Jason struggles out onto the bare patch of ground. He stamps his feet. His breath clouds the air. His hands are very cold. His feet are numb, and he continues walking in a narrow circle near the tree opening, stamping his frozen boots. Gradually, the movement warms him, at least enough to allow him to walk off 10 paces and relieve himself. But to get there, he has to walk through snow. Normally, it might be fun waiting for the season's first good accumulation. Now all he can think of is the way the white powder sticks to his boots and lower pant legs, melting and forming a thin layer of deadly ice. From the vantage of 10 feet of distance, he turns and looks at the woods in which his narrow hovel stands. Under the snow, the woods form a thick wall of white. There are a few large pines still standing, similar to the one that now lies on the ground in front of him. But most of them have toppled, either in last night's storm or in the notorious July 1999 storm. Around them, the open forest floor is thick with new pine growth. Much of it is Christmas tree-sized, some of it taller, some smaller. Taller poplar trunks rise out of the green pine understory. There is a thick red pine near the backside of his hollowed-out tree. Otherwise, the world is a smoldering blanket of white. Jason tries to take stock of himself and his wintry abode. He has to consider the unthinkable, hiking out and trying to find his tent. He needs his food. He needs matches. He knows his only chance of getting truly warm is to find that tent. He gathers his water bottle and places it in his waist pack. But the truth is, he has no idea which way to turn. His tent, he knows, could lie north or south. He is looking for a good open rise above the lake, just on the other side of a bog. He is hoping he can recall the location by sight, but he wonders at the world's transfiguration. Trees are covered. Saplings heavy with snow are bowed over near the ground. He figures that yesterday he must have passed east or west of the lake and then traveled north beyond it. He takes a compass reading south and starts hiking. He's soon wet from his effort. Pushing through the snowy terrain only makes him colder, and the world is so different. Nothing looks familiar. Finally, he is forced to retrace his tracks and return to his hollowed-out tree. He survived last night. The tree should provide shelter for another day. At least he has shelter, he thinks, remembering his book's clear delineation of the basic requirements of survival. Today is Thursday. He won't be coming home. He hopes his mom remembers his admonition just 3 days earlier. If they don't hear from him by Thursday night, call the Lake County Sheriff's Office. He realizes the best he can do now is try and stay warm, to conserve both his energy and his heat. For now, he has plenty of water, and he can always melt snow. He pulls up his water bottle and takes a long drink. He's hungry. He doesn't want to think about it, but the empty gnawing in his stomach is difficult to ignore. He still has a can of tuna, some crackers, and the rest of the water. He cannot stay out in this weather for long. It is still snowing, and he cannot afford to get wet. That would be inviting hypothermia. Hypothermic people don't think clearly. They make stupid decisions, Jason knows. They die. After the feeling has returned to his feet and toes, he turns back into his hollowed-out home. Later, in the afternoon, he rummages through his pack and extracts one pair of crackers. He eats them carefully, one at a time. He sips water in between the satisfying bites, knowing they will be his only food today. He decides to save the tuna. He doesn't know how long he'll be out here. Probably tomorrow, he thinks. They will probably send people out tomorrow. Certainly, they will find him then. He waits until late afternoon before turning back out into the nearby bushes. He has noted the spots where his shelter is weakest, where holes and cracks in its sides and top let through water or wind or the cold air. He takes pains to make his shelter more snug, covering over the top with a lattice work of cut pine boughs. He stacks splintered wood near the sides. He plugs the holes as well as possible, from both inside and out. Throughout the day, the cold presses down, holding the entire region in an icy grip. His hands ache from working outside over the tree. When darkness finally comes, he is ready to return to the narrow confines of his wooden cave. Tomorrow, he thinks, pulling the mesh of pine boughs over the trunk opening. He feels certain they'll come for him tomorrow. Over 250 miles south, in West Bloomington, Minnesota, Linda Rasmussen is anxious to get home. The kindergarten teacher is helping chaperone a roller skating party with her school's kids and their families. She enjoys the work, likes teaching children. It suits her disposition, her patience, and natural empathy. But right now all she can think of is the end of the party, in just moments, and a trip home to hear about her son's adventure. If Jason gets home early, Lee will hear the entire saga, what it was like, where he camped, what he saw, words about the weather. And Jason won't want to repeat it. She knows Lee. If she asks for the trip details, Lee will say, "Well, sounds like he had a good time." So she hurries to her car. She covers the distance from party to home, anxious to see her son, to hear about his trip. The first thing Linda Rasmussen notices is the absence of Jason Saturn. She hasn't missed his stories, but she is not entirely happy about it. All day she has been on a field trip with her kids at the Minnesota Zoo. Although the weather was a blizzarding, sideways slant, she was unconcerned about Jason, because she knew he was already out of the woods and on his way home. Then after school she returned home, and Jason still hadn't arrived, or left a message. Now, after 8 p.m., he is still not home. She pulls into the garage, knowing there will be a message from him, that he is running late, probably because of the storm. She is a little concerned, but tries to consider the positive side. Now she will hear all the wonderful details of his remarkable northern trek. Lee is downstairs watching television.
"Any word from Jason?" she asks,
coming into their kitchen.
"Nothing," Lee yells back. "When did he say he was coming home?"
Linda is surprised. The absence of a message worries her. She tries to recall the details of her conversation with Jason prior to his departure. The one here in their kitchen. She places her coat over a chair. Outside it is clear but blustery. The snow has long since ended, and by tomorrow, weather reports indicate, a warming trend will most likely melt the small accumulation. Neither Lee nor Linda worries about the weather, since it has been a relatively warm fall and the last few days have been mild. Jason was careful to pack for the possibility of colder northern woods. And right now they don't know that the storm up north was much worse than the weather in the cities. For all they know, Jason has been enjoying the same unseasonable warmth.
"He said sometime later today," she finally answers.
"Was he going to get home this late?" Lee wonders.
Linda tries to think. Details like this one, told to her 4 days ago when she wasn't completely focusing, are sometimes difficult to recall. At the time, she remembers there was little reason to worry. Jason was organized, is organized. He is careful, and he was more than a little prepared, with two maps and a good trail description, a clear idea about where he was heading and where he planned to camp each day. She remembers looking over his map, and that causes her to recall the detail about the only optional part of his plan, a possible side hike up the Superstition Trail Spur. She remembers Jason talking about the spur. If he had enough time, he was going to hike it. Now that she is recalling details, another one shakes loose. She is certain she remembers Jason telling her that he would call them Thursday afternoon. She walks downstairs. Lee is sitting on the left side of their corner couch, waiting for the 9 p.m. news, killing time.
"No messages?"
she asks, wanting to be sure.
"Nothing," Lee says.
She can tell from his voice he's concerned, a little edgy, worried about their son.
"I'm going to call,"
she finally says. She doesn't know what the sheriff can do, but she knows that by now she should have heard from her son. The storm complicates his absence, but she remembers Jason's admonition. "If I'm not home by Thursday night, call the sheriff." The Lake County Sheriff's Office is 6 blocks off Highway 61, in Two Harbors, 20 miles up the North Shore from Duluth. With just 3,600 inhabitants, Two Harbors isn't a big town. The highway cuts through the middle of it. Grouped along the highway are restaurants, gift shops, a couple of liquor stores, gas stations, bait shops, and the usual assortment of establishments catering to the tourist trade. On the far northeastern end of town sits a Dairy Queen. Turn right at the DQ, drive 6 blocks to 3rd Avenue, turn right again, and the sheriff's office and jail sit in a squat, yellow brick facility next to the county courthouse. Two Harbors, home of Agate Bay, billed as the busiest harbor north of Duluth, is also the county seat for the second-largest county in Minnesota, at least in terms of landmass. With over 2,000 square miles, the county covers over half the state's northeastern Arrowhead region. It runs from Two Harbors, over 50 miles up the north shore of Lake Superior, to the Cook County line, just northeast of Little Marais. From this southern border, it plunges north in a broad, straight swath to the Canadian border. Over 3/4 of the county is comprised of 4 state parks, the Superior National Forest and the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. The populated quarter is mostly made up of small towns like Knife River, Two Harbors, Beaver Bay, Silver Bay, and Little Marais, all hugging the frigid waters of Superior's North Shore. There are 11,058 citizens in the entire county. Except for Finland, Isabella, and Fall Lake, tiny inland communities, the vast majority of people live on the North Shore. Everyone is surrounded by trees. At 8:38, Linda Rasmussen's call comes through to the on-duty dispatcher. Linda explains about Jason's hike, that he was due back hours ago. She tells the dispatcher where he was going, how long he planned on being away, and his final directive. Missing persons are law enforcement's stock in trade. The dispatcher takes down the information. Then she explains about the weather, particularly further north. There is some snow, but it's not too bad, at least by northern Minnesota standards. She should be able to get a vehicle up in that area before too long. She will check on Jason's car and get back to the Rasmussens, probably within the hour. 70 miles of highway and backcountry roads separate Two Harbors from the Powwow Trailhead parking lot. Fortunately, Lake County is large enough to employ 11 full-time deputies. The deputies divide the county into 3 geographic regions or stations. There are 4 deputies in the Two Harbors station, 4 in the Silver Bay station, and 3 in the Section 30 station, located near Ely at the door to the BWCAW. The 3 Section 30 station deputies cover the northern wilderness areas of the county. Truth is, Two Harbors and the southern part of the county are far enough south, so turf knowledge, or having plenty of first-hand experience of the northern woods, can be significant. On this night, Joe Linneman is Section 30's on-duty deputy. The dispatcher reaches him on the radio and relays Jason's story and the make, color, and model of his car. Joe Linneman has been working as a northern Lake County deputy for over 20 years. In fact, The three Section 30 deputies have a collective 63 years of law enforcement experience. Linneman knows the powwow trail. Since the 1999 blowdown, they have had more than a few calls from people getting lost in the area. From Linneman Station outside of Ely, he takes Highway 1 a little over 30 miles to the Tomahawk Road, then turns left. From here, it is another 20 miles, primarily on dark, unmarked forest roads. But Linneman knows the way. Linneman's four-wheel drive Chevy truck is more than equal to the task of crossing the snow-covered roads. It is a white truck with Lake County Sheriff emblazoned on its side, and the usual overhead lights and siren gear. On the way in, he notices the snow here is deeper, and the road is a wide blanket of white. Moreover, no tire tracks are breaking the pristine plain. There has been no traffic on this road for the last 24 hours. It is the only exit out of the powwow. In most missing person investigations, or at this point, late person, Joe reminds himself, the vehicle is gone by the time he reaches the last known parking point. Usually the missing people are just late. They end up reappearing within a few hours, having pulled to the side of a road for a quick nap or checked into a hotel. That's how most of these incidents end, a little more than wild goose chases, Joe thinks. Finally, a little after 10 p.m., his headlights shine over the trailhead parking lot. The lot is well marked, in large part because of Isabella Lake. This is one of the less frequently used entrances to the BWCAW, but it is at least popular enough to warrant a poster board and a lockbox where canoeists, in season, can drop their BWCAW registration forms. At this late hour, the deputy's headlights turn around the first entrance corner, and there sits a compact car, tucked up against a wall of winter brush, indistinct under 6 inches of white powder. Deputy Linneman gets out of his truck. He brushes snow off the car's hood and shines his flashlight on its metallic finish. Green. When he brushes the rear bumper, he sees it is a Saturn. He flashes on the car's interior. Other than a few food wrappers and the usual assortment of car junk, the inside looks empty and cold. He takes down the car's license number, 478NJA, just to be sure it is Jason's. As he suspected, this is the only car in the lot. He shines his light onto the wall of brush in front of him. It illuminates thick white branches bowed over in the snow. The night is cold and quiet. Linneman walks out far enough to flash the beam of his light over the remaining lot. There are no cars or tracks. That is fortunate, Linneman thinks. At least no one else is out on that trail. He returns to his truck. He switches on his flashing lights. The snow-muffled trees shimmer red and yellow in the spin of lights. He squawks the siren. One good loud burst. If Jason is within earshot, he should hear the siren. He switches it off and listens. The wall of brush in front of him is thick with white fluff. He tries the lights and siren a second time and waits again for a response. But there is only the thick snow and the enveloping darkness beyond the edge of his lights. From this northern reach, radio reception is spotty. Fortunately, the Isabella Lake lot is one of the good spots. He tries to contact dispatch, and her voice comes back scratchy but intelligible. He tells her about the car and gives her the plate number so she can run the license and make sure it is Jason's. Dispatch comes back affirmative, and Joe Linneman knows they will have to reconnoiter in the morning. He tells dispatch he will get back to the office and give Nick Milkovich a call. Milkovich is the on-duty deputy whose shift starts tomorrow morning. Joe Linneman suspects the kid is hunkered down on the trail. Linneman knows hiking on a poorly marked wilderness trail in a snowstorm can be difficult at best, treacherous at worst. If it was him, Linneman knows, he would set up camp and wait for the storm to blow over. In the morning, he supposes, Milkovich will go up in one of the Forest Service planes. With all this fresh snow, Jason will be easy to spot.
"We found Jason's car," dispatch finally relates, when she is able to speak with the Rasmussens. "And I suspect I know what's happened."
For the next 10 minutes, the woman in dispatch relates a theory. They have dealt with this kind of thing in the past. The Section 30 deputies are well acquainted with the woods, especially in winter. If you are on a trail when it starts snowing, It is damn easy to lose your way. More probably, the deputy surmised, Jason recognized the difficulty of traversing through a winter storm and decided to hole up somewhere safe. Deputy Linneman is certain Jason is near the end of the trail, ready to hike out in the morning when the storm passes. What dispatch doesn't tell the Rasmussens is that snow deeper than a couple of inches can obscure everything, particularly a BWCAW trail. Boundary Waters trails aren't supposed to be marked. It is part of the Wilderness Act's requirements. And trails up here are seldom traveled, because most enter the BWCAW by canoe. Hiking out through a foot of snow isn't going to be easy. Linneman is worried, but upbeat.
They'll be ready to search for him at daybreak, dispatch tells the Rasmussens. We have people up here that know the area. I suspect he is close, hunkered down in his tent, she repeats. And fine. I'm sure we'll find him in the morning.
The Rasmussens share a few more details about their son. He is intelligent and prepared, and he has a pretty good idea of what to do in the woods. They also tell her he has maps, a compass, and he was planning on hiking the trail in a counterclockwise direction.
Good to know,
dispatch says, thanking them for the additional information. For now, she thinks, the most viable theory is the one Deputy Linneman proposed. She also knows it is the most comforting. She hopes it is the right one. 14. The Science of Search and Rescue. Quetico Provincial Park, Thursday evening, August 6, 1998. Just after dinner, Constable James McGill and P.C. Jones are nosing their cruiser out of Atikokan, heading out to Highway 11 to start the evening's first patrol. The constables are part of the OPP's mandate to provide the public with general law enforcement across Ontario's non-municipal territory. Like a state patrol in the U.S., the OPP is responsible for patrolling provincial highways. Back at cadet school, general law enforcement had an abstract quality. In the country outside Atikokan, a mining town that dropped from 10,000 to 4,000 inhabitants after the market for ore ran out, the phrase usually meant dealing with domestic disturbances, driving while intoxicated, speeding, parole violations, and the occasional missing person. Now the hard-working Atikokan townsfolk make their living cutting lumber. The town rests atop the million-acre Quetico Provincial Park, a vast forest of thick bush, lakes, and rivers. While no one in Atikokan can touch a sapling in the park, to the east, north, and west, the Ontario woods stretch for miles. Ontario itself is over 1 million square kilometers, much of it rivers, lakes, and woods. With its comparatively small population spread across such a huge geography, the province's police force owns an unusual assortment of tools to cover the territory. Snowmobiles, four-wheelers, beaver planes, and helicopters augment the typical patrol cruisers, and a vast telecommunications network keeps it all connected. The constables are turning onto Highway 11 when a call comes in from the OPP Communications Center in Kenora.
411 Kenora? The
dispatcher announces. McGill picks up the receiver and confirms his number and location. Kenora 411, Highway 11 east of Atikokan. Go ahead.
Sounds like we got a lost person in the Quetico, says the dispatcher. We need you to go back and check it out. Contact the Ministry of Natural Resources over in Atikokan. He's got the details. Over.
McGill thumbs the receiver. 10-4, he says. I will return to Atikokan and contact the MNR. My ETA is 20 minutes. There is a pause on the other end of the line before the definitive response is heard.
Kenora clear,
the dispatcher concludes. Jim McGill hangs up the receiver and turns the cruiser around. That evening, the acting staff sergeant, Phil Donald, works over the forms with McGill. Donald and McGill know questions have to be asked, some of them hard. Laid out on McGill's evening desk are two pieces of paper, the search urgency chart and the OPP's lost person questionnaire. Beside them, his hands finger a white legal pad and a number two pencil. McGill is trying to concentrate. Tools like the search urgency chart and lost person questionnaire make his job easier. But McGill knows enough about human nature to realize these tools are only the surface of the process. For starters, the Mattson method for defining a search area relies heavily on whatever information you can gather about the lost person. Wood's knowledge, character, and personality are top on the list, but never easy to plumb. Interviewees are always quick to tout a lost person's strengths. The initial responses to, "What kind of kid is he?" are as pedestrian as a dollar bill. For example, tonight he has already heard, "Great kid, smart, kind of quiet, and capable." He has also heard plenty of testaments to his Eagle Scout status. All of it McGill patiently transcribes. Jim McGill wants to know about Dan Stevens. He is interested in the kid's dark side as much as the color, sweetness, and light he's been fed during his initial interviews. And he wants to know about the group's dynamics at the time Stevens disappeared. He spends the first hour on the phone with Tim Jones and Jerry Wills. He masters the details quickly enough, bizarre as they sound. But he has to ask, was there any tension in the group? Has Stevens come down on anyone for, say, an inability to keep up or not doing their fair share? Was he a taskmaster in the bush? Did he have any problems with the kids? Any issues with the fathers? Jerry Wills is surprised by the questions, but he answers them all the same. No. In every way, it's as though Stevens was the perfect guide. Knowledgeable, trustworthy, considerate, and except for walking into the woods and not coming out, he has been practically ideal. A regular Mark Trail, McGill thinks. Was anyone even tired of the guy's cooking? But to all of these questions, the answer is the same. Nothing was amiss. He just walked into the woods and disappeared. McGill spends the next hour questioning Doug Hurdler at the Summers Canoe Base. Did Dan have any history of depression? Did he seem gloomy? Did he have a girlfriend? If he was from Georgia, what was he doing in northern Minnesota? Any inconsistency or nuance in the kid's character would draw McGill's eye for salient detail. Only in this case there aren't any problems with girlfriends or disputes with bosses. Dan Stevens doesn't seem to suffer from some post-teenage angst or wanderlust. He doesn't seem to be the kind of young man who would take off on a lark just to prove something, to himself or anyone else. To James McGill, Dan Stevens sounds like everyone describes him. A pretty good kid with plenty of backwoods savvy. In fact, if someone had to go missing in that area of the Quetico Woods, with deep ravines, craggy bluffs, walled bush, swamps, and more bugs than an Amazonian rainforest, Dan Stevens sounds like one of the better choices he had seen. Not only is he an Eagle Scout, he's also familiar with the Quetico. Before McGill rings off with Hurdler, Hurdler asks to be the one to call Dan's parents down in Georgia. It is against protocol, and McGill hesitates. But given Hurdler's excellent cooperation, James McGill decides to make an exception. If they have any questions, he reminds Hurdler, tell them to call the OPP. After hearing all the details, McGill wonders about the kid's absence. When he walked into the woods to find that portage, what happened? He can tell that Jerry Wills and Tim Jones were new to the Quetico Woods, but they had been able to guide themselves through over 20 miles of lakes and rivers, making it to the Prairie Portage Station in pretty good time. And he is impressed by their rapid pace. There were plenty of questions he could have pursued. Why hadn't they spent more time searching for Stevens in that cedar swamp? Why hadn't they set up camp there and waited? Why hadn't they at least kept someone, maybe a couple of them, on the scene while the others went for assistance? The protocol for emergency situations like this one called for the group to split up. But Wills and Jones were adamant about the need to keep their group together. They were responsible for these kids, and above all else they had taken that job seriously. They had left Dan Stevens a cache of supplies and instructions to stay put. But the food in that part of the woods doesn't last long. Most likely it would satisfy the appetite of a passing bear or a couple raccoons. Jim McGill is familiar with one of the woods' unfathomables. When you step off the grid in a place as thick and wild as that part of the Quetico, the wilderness can do strange things to your head. Reason sometimes takes a back seat to instinct, and he can hear it in the father's voices, the drive they had to survive, to bring all their kids out safe. McGill and Phil Donald work their way through the lost person questionnaire, completing the place last seen, subjects trip plans, and subjects outdoor experience sections. Stevens scored high on that one. Most of that subsection's checkboxes, from familiar with the area to will stay put, are marked in the affirmative. McGill hastily completes the contacts upon reaching civilization and actions taken so far sections. After speaking with Doug Hurdler at Summers Canoe Base, he has completed the search urgency chart. The chart comes up with a score of 11. Emergency response. Scores on search urgency charts range from 7 to 21. The lower the number, the more urgent the search. The scores of 7 to 11 merit an emergency response. Scores of 12 to 16 require a measured response. And 17 to 21, evaluate and investigate. The only reason Stevens' score isn't lower? Outdoor knowledge and alleged character, so far as McGill can ascertain. If you disappeared in this part of the world, it was good to be Dan Stevens, providing he could walk and he had no other serious impairments. What didn't make sense was his absence. An Eagle Scout knows to stay put. It deepens the mystery of his disappearance and makes McGill wonder what complicating factor has occurred. After a couple hours and the compilation of the necessary data, McGill hands over the forms to Staff Sergeant Phil Donald. McGill recommends an immediate ERT response. Donald reviews it, then forwards the information to Duty Officer Hugh Dennis with the same recommendation. Hugh Dennis and Inspector Dave Wall give McGill and Donald's work a cursory review. Dennis and Wall are familiar with ERT triggers. It only takes a glance at the paperwork to see that an immediate effort is warranted. Back on his escarpment, the light has all but drained out of the western sky. Dan Stevens descends to a near creek and forces himself to drink water. He climbs to the hillside and rechecks his stick marker pointing east and west. He breaks off another and aligns it perpendicular with his east-west marker, pointing due south. Then he forages on the hillside for broadleaf. He takes off his boxers, ties the legs closed with pieces of twine, and stuffs them with leaves. He lines the birch bark rolls with the broadleaf and with black spruce boughs. This time he vigorously shakes everything lining his bed, careful to make sure it's bug-free. There isn't much grass up on this hillside, and after last night he knows better than to use it. The spruce and broadleaf is a whole lot less comfortable, but at least it's not a mosquito housing complex. He lies down on a scratchy makeshift bed, carefully pulling the huge coils of bark around him. He aligns their seams so they overlap. If it rains, he should stay dry enough. The leaf-stuffed shorts are near his head. It is dusk, and the bugs are starting to swarm. As darkness comes, he lies on the ground, staring through a narrow slit into the night sky. There are so many stars. He is always amazed by the thick Milky Way and profusion of starlight. He stares into it, trying not to think of all the people he suspects may be searching for him, of his parents and their worry. And then he has a sudden, disturbing thought. Why are there no search planes? Not that they'd be able to see him. In order to find him in this brush, they would have to be right on top of him, and it is doubtful they would even see him then. Where are the aircraft? It is a question as prickly as a cockle burr. On the one hand, it implies his disappearance hasn't yet been reported. That is good. He can get himself out. He doesn't want to worry people, particularly his folks. On the other hand, why isn't his absence yet known? Where are his Chattanooga friends? Their plight worries him. He is still their guide, even if he isn't with them. Still, it would be nice to be located by air and picked up. He is hungry. He is damn hungry. He has never been hungrier. He stares into the glittering night sky. So many stars. So many questions. The night is blazing with them. It takes Dan half a second to know there is nothing he can do about his friends, his parents' worry, or the others who may very soon be looking for him. First, he has to take care of himself. He has a plan, and it's a good one. He will walk out under his own power, but he is only partially comforted by the thought. Finally, he pulls his shorts over his head and tries to quiet his mind. It's a worrisome night. At 9:15 p.m., Doug Hurdler is sitting near the phone, a place he hasn't moved from for most of the evening. He is wondering how he can convince Constable McGill to let them assist in the Stevens search and rescue. His crews know that country. They have portaged Bell Lake plenty of times and are very familiar with the man chain. He's feeling frustrated when the phone rings for the last time that evening. It is Jim Stevens, Dan's father. Jim is back home in Monroe, Georgia. Every room in the house is filled with boxes. He and his wife, Mary Ann, Dan's mom, are in the middle of a move from Monroe to Fayetteville. When Hurdler first called, 8:40 p.m., Jim jotted on a notepad as soon as he got off the phone. They had been hip-deep in the innumerable details of packing up a household that had been years in the making. They were stunned. But Jim Stevens served 24 years in the Army, with time in Vietnam. He knows about government response, knows it can sometimes be dubious, ill-considered, and incomplete. He has also seen the opposite. This time Hurdler hears it in his voice. Any previous consideration of packing, moving, attending to the vagaries of household transport have fallen like so much chaff. Jim Stevens is more than over his moment of stunned silence. Now he is focused 100% on the mission at hand, finding and rescuing his son. For the second time that evening, sharp questions fly over the line.
Who's in charge? Was his group still out there? Why didn't anyone hang back? If you've known about this since 5:30, why in the hell did it take so long to call the police?
Jim Stevens continues grilling Doug Hurdler on their search and rescue efforts, wondering why so little is being done, wondering about his son and how they plan to find him. He wants to make sure everything that can be done is being done. Hurdler answers with as much candor and support as he can muster, but it has already been a long day, and the affable officer is grim at the prospect that it is just starting. To Jim Stevens' final question, he wishes he had a better answer. It is one Stevens asks after getting a full sense of where everyone's at in the search for his son. Hurdler, the Summers Canoe Base, the Rangers, and the OPP.
Is anyone even looking for him?
Stevens wants to know. Hurdler pauses and swallows.
Not just yet, he manages. It's night. Tough to fly in. And they wouldn't be able to see anyone if they did. But they're on it, he offers.
Shallow solace he knows, given the facts. A frustrated expletive fires back on the line. After a long pause, he offers Jim Stevens the only hope he has.
Morning, Hurdler manages, low and faint.
1,000 miles away in Monroe, Georgia, Dan's mother hovers over her husband's shoulder. Marianne is waiting for some good news. She is waiting to hear her son has been found. Instead, she can barely pick up Hurdler's voice over her husband's ear and his faint effort to console.
Morning, she hears Hurdler repeat. We should know a lot more then.
Jim Stevens is not satisfied with Hurdler's answer, and tells him so unambiguously. It is a sentiment Doug Hurdler understands. He nods behind the phone and tells them as soon as he hears anything, they will be the first to know. But when he hangs up, he wonders if Dan Stevens is okay. He hopes for the best, knows the young guide, expects him to survive. But the truth is, he doesn't know. Doug Hurdler has spent his life working in the Boundary Waters and Quetico Woods. He knows in wilderness unexpected things happen. He is hoping the young guide got lost, but it doesn't add up. He suspects there was something else, and he hopes like hell the kid's okay. He has tried to assure Dan's mom and dad, but he shares their concern. For now, all they can do is sit, wait, and pray.
15. Lake County Search and Rescue. Northeast of the Powwow Trail. Friday, October 26, 2001. Before first light, Lake County Deputy Nick Milkovich cruises through the small town of Ely, heading toward the U.S. Forest Service's hangar on Chagawa Lake. Late last night, he received a call from Joe Linneman. After the usual banter over the 11 p.m. harassment upsetting the comfort of Nick's home, he listened to his friend and fellow officer. He took down the information about Jason Rasmussen, noting the car in the trailhead parking lot. Nick told Joe he'd be in the skies by first light, providing he could commandeer a pilot and a plane. Given the day's snowfall, its flawless white background, and tomorrow's weather forecast, clear, cold, and calm, Nick suspected Jason Rasmussen would be sipping one of those fancy coffee drinks at Ely's Northern Grounds Cafe by noon. Milkovich has been working as a Section 30 Lake County deputy for over 25 years. He knows the pilots. He knows their routine. He could requisition a plane properly, going through Forest Service HQ in Grand Marais, completing the proper forms and getting the requisite sign-offs and head nods. But the bureaucratic fine points would set his air search back a day. With lost persons, Nick knows, time is critical, particularly in weather like this. So he chooses the more expeditious method, the one in which he's most familiar. He pulls up to the hangar at dawn and knocks on their door. In the early morning light, Jason Rasmussen crawls out of his narrow home, stretches, and starts to stomp, trying to return circulation to his feet and toes. It is cold, but clear. The air is crisp, and he can hear a long way off, though on this morning there is only silence. The snow has muted everything with a heavy blanket, and creatures far and wide are resting beneath it. He guesses there is a foot of snow on the ground. At this point, Jason has no idea of the extent of the storm, the exact snow depth, or the distance it reaches. In another quirky twist, Jason's hollowed-out tree sits in the heart of a mile-wide band of these remote woods where the fall was heaviest. His orange tent, which sits less than a half-mile away on the bare rise above the water, was also situated in the storm's path. Its sides sag under the heavy accumulation. More importantly, he couldn't have done a better job of covering every inch of his orange tent fly if you were spraying it on with a paint gun. Jason would have to be right on top of the igloo-like lump before recognizing it as an anomaly in the landscape, possibly his tent, more likely a boulder. From the air, it's invisible. Just 5 miles southwest, Jason's car sits in the trailhead parking lot in less than 12 inches of snow. Further south, there is less. Jason stays out long enough to stomp his feet and restore some circulation and feeling to his numb toes. He knows the temperature has dropped. Ultimately, the biting cold drives him back into his narrow shelter, where he can better preserve heat and wait for his rescue. He feels certain that today he'll be found. He knows by now his parents will have called the sheriff's office. He knows they will be out looking for him. Maybe they'll send planes. Today he feels confident that, in spite of the snowfall, they will spot him from the air, or call to him from the surrounding forest. He crawls back into his tree, pulls the limbs over his head, and tries to doze. The U.S. Forest Service hangar sits on the edge of Shigawa Lake near the Ely City Dock and Swimming Beach. From here, the Forest Service operates its Northern Air Fleet, 3 vintage red and white de Havilland Beaver planes. The planes have been in operation since the 1950s. Milkovich knows if you give any of the 3 pilots half a chance, they'll wax poetic about their planes, how cheap they are to operate, and how perfect they are for keeping tabs on a canoe wilderness area. In summer, they are rigged as float planes. In winter, outfitted with skis. The 3 pilots, Wayne Erickson, Dean Lee, and Pat Lowe, divide their time between fire spotting, wildlife telemetry tracking, search and rescue, and medevacs. Because air resources are scarce, the Forest Service has an informal loan agreement with the region's county governments. County sheriffs are the point of first contact for search and rescue. Depending upon the nature of the case, the sheriffs have a wide net of government and volunteer resources on which to call. Today, Deputy Milkovich is the point man in the search for Jason Rasmussen. The Lake County deputies are given plenty of leeway for managing their own investigations. On the sheriff's website, the deputies' page notes simply, "All of the deputies do their own investigations as well as performing various civil duties as assigned by the sheriff." In fact, the only reason Milkovich would ever contact Sheriff Steve Peterson regarding an investigation is if he needed more resources. But because Milkovich knows the area and the immediate resources, he has taken matters firmly in hand. On this morning, Pat Lowe answers Nick's early morning knock. Within the first hour of sunlight, Pat has the engine revved and is ready to take off over Shigawa's still, unfrozen waters. The area's lakes are on the verge of freezing, but the pilots are still 2 to 4 weeks from replacing the beaver's floats with skis. The Northern Minnesota branch of the Forest Service is one of the few in the country with its own planes. The 3 de Havillands are loud taking off, loud in the air, and conspicuous. This isn't an advantage for wildlife spotting, but it is helpful in search and rescue. Nick Milkovich has flown on enough search and rescue missions to suspect this one will be over in a matter of hours, if not minutes. The powwow trail is a quick 15-minute fly-in from the Shigawa hangar. While they cover it, they revel in the conditions. a cloudless sky, the air crisp and settled. Their vertical flying column ranges from a low of 400 to 500 feet to a high of 4,000 to 5,000 feet, depending upon the nature of their search. Today, regardless of their elevation, they will be able to see anything that moves. If Jason is out there, and if he's whole, they'll find him. They are hoping he lights a fire. If he does, they will follow the pillar of smoke like a homing beacon. Barring a fire, they are hoping he is on the move, or has the common sense to carve a big SOS in the snow, providing he can find a big enough opening. Nick Milkovich has been in these woods long enough to have hiked over most of its acreage, and plenty of the area surrounding it. And he knows something about the area's history and its plethora of abandoned trails. 25 years ago, Milkovich was broken into his present position by an old deputy named Martin Carlson. Carlson remembered the days when the small logging community of Forest Center sat smack dab in the middle of the current powwow trailhead parking lot. The Forest Service has done an excellent job erasing all traces of the old town. But there was a time, Milkovich remembers, when the small community had businesses, a small logging train station, and logging roads that spun out from Forest Center like spokes on a wheel, connecting a series of makeshift logging camps set up all over the woods around the village. Milkovich knows some of the oldsters who worked in Forest Center before the Forest Service reclaimed the land. They've told him stories, and during the first year he was working, Martin Carlson showed him around. Now, Deputy Milkovich and Pat Lowe turn over the area and examine the parking lot from a few hundred feet. They locate Jason's car, Joe Linneman's tire tracks, and the footprints from his late-night perambulation around the vehicle. They use the spot to plot a course that starts taking them in a straight line up the 2-mile trail to where the powwow circular path begins. First, they do a complete circuit of the 26-mile oval track. Because of the weather and the perfect snowfall, most of the track is a clear white line through the woods. Much of the powwow trail and many of the old logging roads are relatively clear from the air. From this height, with binoculars, they can easily discern wolf tracks. In the past, they've even seen lynx in the snow, pouncing on snowshoe hares, forest voles, or field mice. They've seen plenty of deer, but not many in this area. But the powwow they know is moose country. The bogs and swamps of the region make it ideal for the solitary, horse-sized creatures. They marvel at the numbers they fly over. But there is no sign of a solitary hiker, his tracks, or his orange tent. Milkovich knows the natural boundaries around the powwow trail. They are marked by long water or high ridges, or both. Beyond the western side of the trail rises a high ridge and rough country. That area is also littered with the detritus from the 1999 blowdown. The deputy has struggled through those areas on foot, and it is virtually impassable. Few people would trouble themselves crawling over and under so many fallen trees. Arrow Lake lies 3 or 4 miles to the east of the trail. That entire area is covered over by beaver ponds, bogs, and swamps. Milkovich would be surprised if Jason was anywhere east of the trail. Just to double-check, not more than an hour after they have been up over the trail, they fly out beyond the east side of the powwow, their eyes scanning bogs, swamps, beaver ponds, and occasional islands of pine. Around 9:30 a.m., Jason is roused out of his tree by a low, far-off drone. It sounds like a plane. He has been dozing off and on. Now he is suddenly awake. He is pretty certain it's the sound of a plane. He pushes off the top branches of his hovel and quickly wiggles out. The sounds grow louder. The plane, it is definitely a plane, now he's certain of it, is coming closer. It veers in from the west-southwest. He hears its approach. The drone rises in volume over the trees. He doesn't know what to do. He tries to move to the most open spot, but the cover around his tree is thick. He moves 10 paces from the fallen log, and then he sees it. A small red and white plane with floats. It comes up fast, and Jason jumps up and down, waving in the middle of his narrow opening. The plane passes over without a sign. Jason reaches down to the orange lanyard around his neck and pulls out his whistle. He starts blowing. He blows frantically, waving, though the plane is moving away, starting to disappear. In a matter of seconds, it pushes east and disappears over the treetops. He listens as the drone winds down like a dying insect. He whistles again.
The piercing signal shrieks over the woods. He blows off and on for at least another minute. Then he stops, his heart pumping and breathing heavy. The view of the plane gave him a sudden rush of hope. Jason knows the plane cannot hear him, but the plane, he assumes, must be accompanied by ground searches. To hear his whistle, they would have to be close, probably within a mile. But they must be out, already combing the trail and the woods around it. And by his own estimation, he is near Poe's Lake. The small lake is close, so if searchers come up the trail and make noise, he will hear it. After a minute, he repeats his efforts with the whistle and then stops and listens. Nothing. Still, the sight of the plane stirs his optimism, and he hopes it will be back for another foray. The pilot and deputy swing east over the long north-south boundary of Arrow Lake, but see nothing. There are one or two stray moose east of the lake, struggling over the snowy terrain, but otherwise nothing. Jason could have stayed north, but in just 2 to 3 miles his path would be blocked by the massive Lake Insula and its connecting waterways. Still, they wing northward up to Insula and along its ragged southern shoreline. Nothing. Every 20 to 25 minutes, Milkovich or Lowe is in touch with Lake County Dispatch or the Forest Service hangar. Throughout the morning they give periodic updates of their progress, or lack thereof. Twice they return to the hangar to refuel. But the powwow is only 15 minutes from Shagawa, and it takes less than 45 minutes before they are back up over the area, resuming their grid search. Other than the wildlife, the woods appear empty. After their initial circumnavigation of the trail and their review of the natural boundaries east, north, and west, Pat Lowe lays out a grid, minding Milkovich's designated borders. For this initial grid, Milkovich and Lowe agree. The smart money is on the area inside the large oval trail. Both of them believe it would be the most obvious place to run astray. They spend the first half of the day covering the ground from a high elevation, looking for smoke or some other sign. Over the course of the day, they lose track of the number of moose they see. By early afternoon, they are flying lower, under 1,000 feet, crisscrossing the trail's center and pushing out beyond the trail on all sides. They hope the closer look will yield a better examination of the ground. But by this time, both men believe they should have found him. They should have seen his tent, or if he moved at all, seen his tracks, or caught him struggling through the snow. 3 more times throughout the day, Jason hears the plane's steady, low drone. Once it swings south, but almost out of earshot. Another time it passes south, but just barely, coming in closer. Both times, Jason waves and dances on his small clearing of snow. He picks up his orange whistle and blows. Once, the plane passes further north, but too far to be seen. In the hopes of extending his reach, he picks up a long spruce bough from the side of the hollowed-out tree, one he used earlier for insulation. Now he waves the tree branch high overhead, waving it back and forth like a deep green flag. After the plane starts to recede, Jason blows his whistle and yells. Maybe the on-ground searchers are close, he thinks. And the effort to signal them comforts him. More importantly, hearing the plane search all day has been reassuring. If he is not found today, then tomorrow. Part of him worries about how long air searches will continue. But for now, he places that anxiety aside. He knows they are going to find him. He is certain it will be soon. Though they haven't given him any indications, he secretly wonders if the plane may have spotted him, and is even now signaling his coordinates to the ground searchers. He tries to keep himself from too much idle dreaming, but it is quiet in the snowy woods, and he has time. For most of the day, he stays in this hollowed-out tree, struggling to retain his heat. This day is cold and clear, and he needs to conserve his energy. He spends his brief outside moments tightening and insulating his tree. He cuts nearby boughs and lays them against the side of his log. He lines the inside with as much greenery as he can fit into the narrow enclosure. He looks for cracks and holes and plugs them. Later, in the afternoon, he remembers his last small package of crackers. Without anything to eat all day, he has grown progressively more hungry. He has only a little water left in the one bottle. His other bottle has been lost under the snow. But in any case, it was already empty. He decides he has to eat something. He figures the crackers might assuage his pangs better than the tuna. Jason knows he has to keep some in reserve. If he is not found in the next hour, he will be here another day. He only has the pair of crackers and the canned fish. Finally,